Let me just begin by welcoming the audience. About a year ago, Mark Charandoff and Ariella Saperstein of the Maimonides Fund called me up for a conversation about the possibility of beginning some kind of journal, which we had initially imagined would be perhaps a single journal or a short run effort to have a conversation at a high level on the subjects that mattered most to the Jewish people. And after thinking about it for a while, we decided to call it Sapir, with the subtitle A Journal of Jewish Conversations. And that's what we've been trying to do. And it seems to have met with a very enthusiastic and interested audience of people who care passionately about the future of the Jewish people in Israel, here in the United States, and in Europe and elsewhere in the diaspora. So we've had this wonderful series of author conversations. I think you must be the ninth, or maybe the 10th. And you contributed really a superb essay on the seven pillars of Jewish wisdom. We named it, we gave it that title after your favorite Arabist, T.E. Lawrence. I thought, I hoped you'd appreciate it. In a journal that is entirely devoted to the subject of continuity. We have tried to organize Sapir, each issue of Sapir, around a single subject. So the first one was on social justice, the second one on power, the third, the one you're in, on continuity. The next one is going to be on Jewish aspiration. And then we're already talking about a fifth journal on the subject of Zionism. So this enterprise is growing, but growing, I think, within relatively a modest ambit, because we want to be read by people who are really passionate about the things that we are passionate about. So I want to begin with your essay, which really has a lot of rhetorical power, and in particular, I want to start with your diagnosis, Liel, of the Jewish scene, because you paint a fairly dark picture, nothing less, as you put it, than perhaps the end of what's been known as the Enlightenment for the last 350 odd years.
Only so, that.
Sorry?
Only that and nothing more.
Only that and nothing more. So let's begin with that. Why are you think, what is it about the last few years that leads you to draw such a kind of a dire picture?
You know, it's a question that I've reflected on myself a lot. Perhaps it has to do with my own journey. I'm somewhat of a political itinerant myself. I sort of stumbled my way from the warm bosom of the center left and towards other realms that today will probably be defined more as the right. And as I started asking questions, I noticed something very curious, which is that you're increasingly not allowed to ask questions. And as I saw it myself, I began, of course, to see it everywhere. And notice when other people would say the same things to me, you know, you would get notes saying things like, well, I don't understand why we have spent the last 30, 40, 50 years sort of espousing the values of free speech, only to then suddenly turn on a dime and decide collectively that there were some form of speech that, because they hurt this group or another, were all of a sudden verboten. Or I don't understand why, after we have kind of spoken and extolled the virtues of science and free, unfettered scientific inquiry, all of a sudden just asking a subset of questions pertaining to actual available data gets you labeled an anti-vaxxer, a Trumper, an extremist. And it was these labels that first turned my attention to the fact that there's something happening here. The fact that
just let me break in for a second. Is this the kind of, to what extent do you think this is a function of being a denizen of the Upper West Side and a product of its institution, exactly, higher education, or is this a broader phenomenon?
Well, at first, that was precisely my diagnosis. My diagnosis was, you know, to quote my good friend David Goldman, it's not the end of the world, it's just the end of you, right? That the problem wasn't extensive in America, it was just my sort of sick class of people who engage needlessly in mental self-gratification between, you know, standing online and Zay bars. But then, as I'm fortunate enough to have the kind of job that in the before times enabled me to travel all over the United States and talk to real Jews who lived in real places, I saw it all over the place. People who just come and say, you know, if you ask me, I'm this just middle of the road centrist Jews voted Democrat her entire life. And all of a sudden, I support Israel. And this became very evident in, you know, last May during the war with Gaza. I support Israel, and my entire sort of social media circle rises up and calls me a white supremacist and suggests I check my privilege just because I'm, you know, just a middle of the road Zionist. And so I don't think it's a problem that only bedevils us chattering classes in the corridor between Connecticut and Manhattan. I think it's actually a real sea change in American life. I think it's extremely pernicious. And if I were to diagnose this, it results very heavily. And I say this even though I'm you know, sometimes fond of combative rhetoric myself. I take no pleasure in diagnosing that we're increasingly being divided into two distinct camps of people, into two distinct camps of Americans, each one with a very deliberate worldview. On the one hand, and you know, we could spend a lot of time just unpacking this, but I think on the one hand, are people for whom the natural course of things, a natural state of nature, if you will, is a sort of struggle between individuals over the question, as Leonard Cohen so wonderfully put it, the homicidal bitchin that goes down in every kitchen to determine who will cook and who will eat. I think those people look at the family, they look at the church, they look at the nation, and they see very little but huge battlegrounds between different groups of people, the oppressors and the oppressed, and they see progress, they see the course of history and politics as a mission dedicated to championing the causes of those who they perceive to have less power. On the other side of this divide are poor schlubs like us, and I'm very happy to put myself in this category, who don't tend to work for large universities, at least not anymore, or write for legacy publications or produce Hollywood movies, and who believe uncomplicatedly that the family is a net good, that religion, for all of its problematic kind of censures that it sometimes puts on us, is a vital beating heart that leads us forward, that look at the nation and say that for all other systems, you know, but for all other systems, this is the one with which we're stuck. And
can I break in for 1 second, Leo?
Sure.
I mean, what you're saying is so kind of pregnant with interesting ideas, but this is something that I think about a lot. You're painting a picture of a cultural sphere which is broken down into two camps, broadly speaking. One is a progressive left, which is essentially sees the world in Manichaean terms as a death struggle between the forces of universalism, although not entirely universalistic, the forces of progress, liberation of every kind from nation, religion, and so on, gender even, versus another group, which is, as you put it in your essay, Zionist. It believes in the family, it believes in religion or one's synagogue, one's church, and it believes in the nation. And missing, it seems to me, in that picture, and I'm interested to know your analysis here, missing in that picture is what used to be called the old school liberal, who had it in his mind that we could be both universalistic and particularistic. We could belong to a synagogue and be faithful citizens of a republic of e pluribus unum. We could, in a sense, have it both ways, which I kind of feel is still my camp, although I wrestle with this a great deal. Who said there's no contradiction between being loyal to your family, your faith, and your nation, and still holding these ideals about equality, universality, and so on, that these things could coexist. And what you seem to have suggested in your essays, that third alternative is no longer present.
If only it were. I pine for it. I yearn for it. Like you, it is the sort of the glimmering fantasy that in my most cheerful moments, I want to believe is still within reach. But this, I think, is why the historical analysis is so important. Here we are, all believing that what was in our lifetime is what will forever be. But I think if you look at history with a somewhat sober look, you look at this period, the Enlightenment, which sort of bounded about after the Peace of Westphalia, as Europe emerged from bloody holy wars that decimated, by some accounts, up to 50% of its population. And then charged on and gave us, as I write in the piece, everything that was good and sort of life-affirming, from medical science to double-stuffed Oreos, which I considered, one of the peaks of human creation. And liberalism could benefit from it. It could soar. It could give us the comfortable, the fertile soil in which this beautiful, tender ambiguity that you described so nicely could flourish, could bloom, precisely because it was always held in check by two institutions. These institutions were the family and the church, synagogue, the mosque, etc. Those that tethered us to tradition, that reminded us that there was something really strange at the heart of this whole social contract idea. I mean, you read social contract theories, very much at the heart of liberalism, very much at the heart of the Enlightenment. And it's as if we all arrived to the table unmoored by relations to tradition, to religion, to family, to tribe, to soil. We just enter as fully formed, free individuals who are free to trade small rights and liberties in return for security, which is why a French intellectual I like said that the fathers of liberalism, the intellectual founding fathers of liberalism, were all men without children who had forgotten what it was to have been children themselves.
This was who's this?
That was Juvenal.
Okay.
Who said that some years ago, and I think with a great degree of insight, because once, and I think this is the result of the last 40 or 50 years, especially in American life, once the family, for all sorts of reasons, has been I don't want to say eradicated, but certainly eroded. We live now in a society in which the family is no longer at the focal point of anyone's concerns, and also a plummeting birth rate and a soaring rate of unwed young Americans. Once the church/synagogue lost all of its real influence and impact, liberalism found itself in the unenviable position of being the dog who actually caught the car it was chasing. And once that happened, I think realized, much to the chagrin of all of us, that the theories that it espoused were actually, at the very least, at an angle to many foundational principles of human nature. And so do I wish that we were still at a period in time in which I grew up, in which you grew up, in which probably a lot of people listening grew up, in which we could say, yes, there are so many wonderful ambiguities and complexities, and you could believe X and Y and Z, very much so. But some of us are just doomed to live in period of historical transitions, and it is sadly not up to us to choose them.
Okay, Boetius. I'm not sure I agree with the analysis, but I want to move forward with yours. In particular, I want to move forward with the question of how this plays upon the Jewish community in the United States, and how this plays within it. And take those in whatever turn you'd like.
Gewalt. How does it play? Let's start with how does it play upon it. I think it plays upon it in a period of or in a sort of a fiery thrust of great confusion, because that type of comfortable middle that you describe, and please, I don't mean to denigrate it. I truly crave it and miss it. I came of age in the 1990s, the best of all possible worlds, a time in which we thought, you know, it was the end of ideology.
By the way, just for the record, as I remember the 1990s, when I was starting in journalism, civilization was collapsing. We had an immoral president abusing his office in the White House. Robert Bork had a bestseller called Slouching Toward Gomorrah. And the other bestseller was A Book of Virtues, in order to revitalize these vital virtues. So there is a quality of remembering the past as something better than it might
have. Fall of communism and Kurt Cobain. That's right. what I bring in my historical memory. But I think that this state of being of call it, and I don't mean this as a derogatory term, this knee-jerk liberalism has defined the sort of warm middle of American Jewish communal life for a very long time, which led to this tendency to basically look at your Judaism like an escrow account. It was something that was there in case you needed it. You made very small deposits and not really expected to draw from it, because your primary identity was as an upwardly mobile, educated, middle-class American. I think that these tremors have left a lot of American Jews startled, and you see it play out in disparate arenas. College, most famously and best known, and therefore probably left best least described right now, in which American Jewish families are all of a sudden starting to think, you know, why little Timmy and Susie are being treated with such, you know, suspicion and contempt by so many of their peers, and required to make all kinds of statements of allegiances to political ideologies that they may or may not hold. You see it in the media, which I think has crossed a Rubicon of sorts, moving from what once used to be called lack of objectivity, which I would define as a sort of delta between observable reality and whatever biases that you may or may not have, and crossed over into complete, you know, information operation geared towards a very specific set of ideology. This makes a lot of American Jews very uncomfortable. And I think a lot of trying to ask, like, what happened? Why did everyone all of a sudden go so crazy? And when they try to answer this question, whatever answers we give are necessarily incomplete. We speak about woke. We speak about the left. The truth of the matter is that it's not necessarily a problem that resides in one political camp or another. It's really kind of a big institutional shift, because American Jews got comfortable to a certain version of America. And once that version begins to shift, we have to ask ourselves what it is that we want to be, which leads me to what happens within the Jewish community. What happens as a result of this is a point of great transition in which people, I think, are beginning to understand. And it's very important to me to say that, whereas I sound like a complete raving lunatic who's visited the bar cart behind him one time too often, I'm actually incredibly optimistic for the future, because I go again to all these communities and I see that people are beginning to understand that it's not enough anymore to be Jewish. You have to actually do Jewish. You have to actually engage in, you have to first of all have this kind of courage of your convictions and do as the early Zionists did, and basically say, I don't freaking care what you say or not say. I'm not going to participate in your games. I'm going to step aside and do my thing independently. And second of all, are beginning to understand that attitude has to be accompanied with action, with endeavors that root us right back into our tradition, not in our tradition as a conduit to social justice, environmental understanding, interracial relations. All these things are nice and good and well, but in our tradition as a source of light and drive, as it has always been since time immemorial.
Let me ask you about that. There was a lengthy article in my own legacy media publication, not Sapir, but my other job, from your former colleague, Mark Tracy, on the, I don't want to say increasing, but the pronounced anti-Zionism or Zio-skepticism prevalent in parts of the future rabbinical community of the United States. Is that an example of kind of doing your own thing and doing Judaism? I mean, given what you just said, how do you look at a phenomenon like that?
With a bemused smirk, because first of all, I think that if you're deeply immersed in American Jewish life and not trying to, and this is in no way at all a criticism of Mark's article, which I confess to not having had the time to read, but if you're looking at American Jewish life, you understand how wonderfully and blissfully trivial, albeit very vocal, this group of call them whatever you want, let's be generous here and call them dissenters, truly are. I don't think they represent even a fraction of what we call with a lot of love and respect, Amcha, actual Jews who have actual interest in actual real Jewish communal life. This is a small scrum of detached, deluded young people who are, you know, some of them, I'm sure, out of very, very good and virtuous motives. Some of them, I think, probably out of more sinister aspirations, are expressing these ideas, which leads me to the second part of your question. Do I consider them to be Jewish? You know, I want to riff here and say, my good friend Rabbi Dr. Ari Lamb came up with a game a couple of years back, which I actually think would behoove all of us to play. It's like, you should get Jew points for every actual Jewish thing that you do. Even if you are an rabbinical student or work for a Jewish organization, there should be like a point system. You pray Shacharis, 5 points. Speak Hebrew, 10 points. Keep kosher, 15 points. Not just in terms of observance, but in terms of an actual lived Jewish life. You could only say, as a Jew, I believe, if you have, say, 500 points and more. I think that is a very lengthy way of saying that I think a lot of the things that they're saying are deeply, deeply, deeply antithetical to core teachings and principles of Judaism. I think upon reflection, I don't want to direct, not having read a piece and not wanting to necessarily direct my comments to any specific individuals, but very often when you see people like that, it strikes me as if they are they're quickly and proudly waving Judaism's banner in order to promote causes and goals that have absolutely nothing to do with the real life interests, spiritual, emotional, financial, and others of actual Jews.
Well, this is a theme of Ruth Weiss's book on the Jews in power and the. This is Ruth's view of in every Jewish community a wicked son whose goal it is to put themselves on the side of those in power in order to say, let me tell you about the Jews. I'm paraphrasing Ruth's view. I'm not sure that's the case in the students that Mark profiled in his article, which is worth reading, agree or disagree. I want to talk a little bit about your prescriptive side, the seven pillars of modern Jewish wisdom. And the first one is think small, which is not something that comes very naturally to a lot of Jews, right? All of us want to be Moses or some kind of prophet. So how does one go about thinking small? What's the prescription here?
Well, first of all, I think it stems from remembering how we're set upon to pray. We don't pray in groups of one, and we don't pray in groups of 100. We pray in groups of 10. And it's guaranteed that out of these 10, there'll be at least 7 that we can't stand and like one that we still aren't sure about and only maybe one or two people we actually like. The minion, the quorum, is such a genius invention because it reminds us of precisely this principle. If you're just there at home with your talis and you're into feeling like rocking by yourself, well, you're having a wonderful experience, but you're having it alone and that's not how we live life. If you're one of 100 or 1,000 or 10,000, well, you know, you're just a face in the crowd. The idea is the quorum. The idea is the locality. The idea is to stand there with a small group that you actually get to know, even and especially if you don't really like them or get along with them very well. That teaches us that rather than try to find kind of catch-all solutions that go viral. I mean, even listen, there's nothing more goyish than the language of our particular moment in time. Too big to fail. This has to go viral. It has to be scalable. No, because what works for, you know, a synagogue in Cleveland may not necessarily work.
I mean, these are all terms that probably emerged from some Jewish VC somewhere, but go
correct.
Ahead.
As Ruth said, in every community, there's a wicked son. You know, I think that once we realize that what works for one community doesn't necessarily work for another,
Can you be a little drill down here for a moment? Sorry to interrupt you, but I'm Jewish, so I get to interrupt. Drill down for a second, because as you mentioned in earlier on, before pre-COVID, you would travel around and meet various Jewish communities. I mean, what's an example of doing something well small that caught your eye?
Here's a classic example of that. A community that has a large number of young and sort of extremely literate people who felt deeply kind of moved and troubled by the idea that their proximity to and knowledge of classical Jewish texts weren't nearly as it should be, started a sort of Scotch and Talmud club in which Thursday after work, I believe it was either JCC or Shul, provided free childcare for 2 hours, provided a very nice selection of Scotch and a few snacks, and a sort of guided conversation that allowed these people, all of whom in their 40s, all of whom feeling, you know, out of the pressure of raising very small children, but before kind of the stage where kids start to be old enough to go to college, allowed them a couple of hours a week to feel like they're really grappling with Jewish ideas and Jewish texts in a way that rekindled in them the kind of intellectual vibrancy that they still crave and that they felt much more acutely when they were still graduate students, because it was a highly professional class. So that worked very well for this community. For a different community, for example, where people were primarily older, needed a completely different kind of, this I believe is somewhere in Colorado, although again, it's been a moment, needed a totally completely different sort of engagement, needed something that felt much more attuned to daily events, current events, needed a sort of a weekly kind of almost like a newspaper reading club and guest lecturers that spoke about current events, because the focus at that point was, you know, what's going on in the world, which they felt they weren't getting enough of now that they've retired and haven't had, you know, didn't have that much more of an opportunity in their professional lives to be kind of tethered to the news cycle. These are two totally different solutions to totally different ideas, but what they both have in common is a distinct kind of attunedness to the individual needs and sensibilities of a community, which sometimes, as we sit in our ivory towers in New York or LA or elsewhere, we tend to forget as a thing. We tend to sort of prescribe like, oh, well, you know, we need to spend X millions of dollars on a program that does a catch-all solution for all, that creates something that is uniform, customizable, scalable. That doesn't always work. I think what works is listening to people in distinct communities, giving them the opportunity to chart their own courses, inviting them into the conversation. How often would you go to a sort of a Jewish professional setting, a conference, and meet, you know, a host of people who all live
right. With, I mean, what you're getting
five
at
miles of each other
is, in a sense, that every community should be small enough that every person feels they have a distinctive voice and are heard, which is extremely
yes.
difficult to do, you know, when there are 18,000 people in a convention hall or mm-hmm. whatever it is. Your second point, you call it "Don't be stupid," but I would paraphrase it as the anti-Hasbara mm-hmm. Manifesto. Mm-hmm. Say a word about that.
Well, you know, honestly, and
well, and by the way, I'm interrupting you again. I'm just looking at the clock, and in about 10 or 15 minutes, I'm going to start opening up our conversation to audience questions. There are over 200 of you on this call, and yet only 5 questions. There are 200 Jews listening to this, and only 5 questions, which makes no sense. So this is the time for those of you in the audience to start thinking of questions that you want to ask Liel. Now let's go back to just this, the anti-Hasbara clause.
I say this as a former officer in the Israel Defense Forces spokespersons unit and a former press officer for the Israeli consulate in New York. There is nothing, nothing more absolutely supremely freaking idiotic than this cult of Hasbara. I mean, Israel to this day has a foreign minister who said just recently, well, if only we found a way to tell our story compellingly enough, they will understand that we are right. This constant effort to explain ourselves, to speak, to convince, to kind of really try to put our best face forward. To me, that is the most asinine thing. If Zionism, imagined in its purest form, taught us everything, anything, it's that, if you find yourself in a situation surrounded by people who seem to hate you, leave. Go to your own place and do your own thing. Hasbara rests on, I write in the piece, I want to read this because I think it rests on three fallacies. First, that we have an obligation to explain ourselves. Second, that people who hate Jews can be convinced if only presented with the right facts in the right order. And third, that even if we didn't win any converts, there's intellectual and moral merit in a well-crafted argument. I think that's completely wrong. I don't care what Sally Rooney thinks about Israel. I don't care what some nitwit in Hollywood thinks about, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu. Who cares? I have a country. I am rooted in a tradition. And I care about making it, you know, brighter and better, not in constantly waging, you know, asinine, quixotic wars, especially online, with people who will never, ever be convinced to stop hating me. The fact that we are so obsessed with it, that we invest so many resources in getting others to like us, to me, that's the most kind of exilic mindset thing. It's the most kind of...
I challenge you, Liel, and this is just by way of, you know, the two of us as friends talking. I mean, I agree with a lot of what you've just said, to the extent that the idea of engaging Sally Rooney, for those of you on the call who don't know this, she's an obscure Irish author who made a name for herself by refusing to get books published, her books published into Hebrew. I think nobody in Israel would want to read her books in Hebrew or in English or anywhere else. That's beside the point. The point is, you are never going to win over your committed haters. But I would argue here, and this is, I think, a deeper feeling in the Jewish community, which is that the Jewish community has attempted Hasbara in all the wrong places, which is to say, go to Brown University and try to make the case for Zionism on up there in Rhode Island. Where Hasbara never takes place, and I'm curious to know your thoughts, is, I mean, I'm just picking these names out of a hat, the University of Nebraska. There are plenty of people who might be inclined to listen to a pro-Israel message because they're not previously encumbered by the baggage of, call it what you will, wokeism, progressivism, or out and out anti-Semitism that happens elsewhere. Maybe we're just not doing it in the right place.
This I agree completely. This leads me to the fourth prescription in my piece. Know who your friends are. You know, so often, we're like that sad student in high school who's, you know, pining for the girl that will never even look his way. We have such
You're not speaking autobiographically.
Of course not. I mean, come on. A guy who dresses like this? I think high school really has, by the way, we can ask, especially us as Jews, we could ask for no better yeshiva and no better house of learning and preparation for the future than high school, because high school teaches us exactly this lesson. It's so much of it is about attitude. If you spend your days being, please, please like me, please be my friend, you're all but guaranteed, again, not from experience here, to be the person sitting by themselves in a sort of, you know, periphery of the cafeteria. If you just say, look, I'm just going to do my own freaking thing here. And by the way, if you think that's interesting or cool, I would love to be your friend. There are so many Americans, so many groups of Americans that already feel and think this way, and yet mention them in most mainstream Jewish setting, and you get this kind of notion like, oh, Christians, well, they only like us because they want us all to go to Israel and then die in a flame of fire when Jesus returns. Oh, conservatives, well, they're weird because they vote for the party that we're constantly told is basically the Nazis. Immigrants, I don't know about them. The truth and the reason I'm so optimistic, I think a majority of this country, I'm going to put this number at 80%, sees or at least has interests that are 100% completely aligned with the true interests of American Jews, people who have, you know, strong traditional family values, people who are interested in continuing their commitment to their faith tradition, people who are deeply grateful for the opportunities that this incomparable, unparalleled nation has given them and their loved ones. Those are the people we need to stand with, not a few writers in newspapers that should remain nameless, but have afflicted you particularly with enough pain and heartbreak.
Well, it's an interesting point, and I will lightly pass over the last thing you said. But you know, about 10 years ago, Leon Panetta went to Israel at the very beginning of what was then called the Arab Spring, and basically lectured the Israelis and said, look, all these wonderful things are happening in the Arab world. And if you don't move swiftly in the direction of more concessions, territorial concessions to the Palestinians, if you don't essentially get right with the international community, was Panetta's analysis, then Israel would be more isolated than ever. The Israelis listened to him, did exactly the opposite. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, Israel's diplomatic, strategic, economic integration, not just never mind the Abraham Accords with the UAE and Bahrain and Morocco and so on, but with the Greeks, with the Ugandans, with the Indians, with the Japanese, around the world, those relationships all blossomed precisely because Israel was not essentially panting for what was supposed to be, you know, the right kind of support from the right kind of people. It found friends where it could find them, and it reciprocated that friendship in ways that it was capable of reciprocating. Another point, you say just do it, and what does this exactly mean in practice?
I think it means,
I mean, other than, you know, be like Mike,
right? I think it means acknowledging that the only type of Jew you don't want to be. There's so many wonderful and diverse ways to be Jewish. The only type of Jew that you don't want to be is a dumb Jew. If there's one way of being Jewish.
Is there some other way of being a Jew?
there are many other ways of being Jewish, because I think if this world is predicated on anything, it's predicated precisely on engagement with learning, with thinking, with reading, with doing, with arguing. Arguing what, reading what, thinking about what? The truth is that it doesn't matter. If your commitment is to study a page of Talmud a day, as yours truly does on a podcast and many other people do, that's great. If it's learning abyssal Yiddish on the Duolingo app, awesome. If it's sitting down and reading one serious book, if it's just holding space with other Jews once a week, twice a week, you don't like the synagogue, do it over the dinner table. You don't feel comfortable at the dinner table, do it in some exercise group. Whatever it is that you want to do, it's this commitment, again, to understanding that you can't, we no longer have the privilege to be Jewish. If we want this to continue, if we want this to thrive, we have to do Jewish. This is not, again, this big escrow account that you could just set it and forget it. You have to continue and work at growing it, which is something that I think is happening everywhere you look. The amount, the sheer volume and creativity of engagements and endeavors that I see every day are astonishing. From film clubs to reading groups to podcasts that listen. I have a friend who started a podcast that listens to other podcasts and then analyzes the other podcast on the podcast like it was a Talmudic text, like they were the Gemara analyzing the Mishnah while bringing in classical Jewish sources. There's no end to what you could do if you just kind of really plug into something that matters to you. The only thing you shouldn't be doing is saying, I'm Jewish because I like bagels and Seinfeld, oy vey. That paradigm is dead.
Yeah, well, look at what I have here. It's a huge care package from Zabar's.
And how does that make you feel, Brett?
Well, because I have no taste or smell, it makes me feel like the eunuch at the orgy. Right. But at some point I'll be able to savor it. We're going to go to the audience questions in 1 second, but just one last question for you on that issue of doing Jewish as opposed to being. To what extent is Zionism essential to doing Jewish in your view?
In my view, it is incredibly central because understood correctly, Zionism is much less, and this again opens up a whole kind of box of wonders. It's much less a 19th century movement for the national homeland of the Jewish people and the Jewish, et cetera, et cetera. It is much more of a quasi, or even without the qualifier, a messianic movement that captures our never-ending yearning to return to our indigenous homeland, to once again have power and control over our own destinies. And even if you don't agree with this policy or another of a current or former or future government in Israel, that yearning beats somewhere deep down within your heart. Now, it's quite possible to be anti-Zionist, as some of my Haredi friends are and some of my progressive friends are, and still feel the same kind of deep mystical calling to these foundational tenets of Judaism. But I think for the most part, these yearnings are central to who we are as a people, and Zionism is but the most recent name we've given them.
So let's now turn to audience questions, and I'm going to turn to the easiest to dispatch first, from Sandy Zioli. Give us the name of your French philosopher again.
Bernard de Juvenal.
Bernard de Juvenal. Okay, I hope Sandy got that. Let me take a look at some of these questions, and I always try to look for the questions of that are the most contentious on the theory that we don't want to dodge hard questions. So Edward Beck writes to you. He says, with all due respect, as a 2G. I think the rising tide of anti-Semitism and anti-Israelism cannot be dismissed and has never ended well for the Jewish community. It's not enough to know who your friends are, and it's not enough to lay out the truth, Hasbara, or the facts. It's also not enough to be a good Jew scoring 500 points to earn the privilege of saying with authority, I believe. There comes a time, as all survivors and 2Gs, Israelis know that there comes a need not to be clever, but to be a warrior in order to survive. Jewish history is filled with warriors. What is your advice for Jews in the diaspora to be warriors for Judaism?
I first of all, right on, brother. I agree 100%. The sort of sense of being too smart to survive is one that I find, I would find comical if it wasn't so tragic and troubling. You know, the notion that so often when attacked, we sort of do backflips to say, well, no, you misunderstood what she said. She says she hates all Jews. What she really meant was that she disagrees with Benjamin Netanyahu's policies and the occupied West Bank. Enough with that. I think it is very, very clear to learn how to be much less smart and much more attuned. And how to be a warrior, it's very simple. Refuse to engage with any one individual, organization, political party, or cultural movement that doesn't take your safety, well-being, and inalienable rights seriously. And here, if you want to know how to do it, start with your own camp, because we're sadly, again, in a time of these tribal divisions. Look at your own political quorum, at your own milieu, at your own backyard, and see which among them, if any, hold views that if they belonged just to someone on the other end of the divide, you would find indefensible. And if you're still willing to continue and grapple with them, well, then we have a really, really big problem. Sometimes it calls for difficult conversations and messy breakups, but I think it's a good first step. And then have a zero tolerance policy for anyone who says anything that if you switch the word Jews to literally any other group in America, would be seen as a disgusting, unacceptable, racist, white supremacist, et cetera, comment, then you shouldn't accept it either.
Irene Lancaster, I just should note, corrects me. And thank you for the correction, Irene, that Sally Rooney is not obscure. Our local library in Greater Manchester will now ban her books as a result of her stereotypes. I would only say that here in semi-literate America, Sally Rooney is very obscure. but thank you for correcting me there.
The author of Facebook posts masquerading as novels.
You've read her.
Sadly.
Sorry. Regarding the above question, our daughter works with the Jewish Persian community in Los Angeles. They are terrified because of the medical apartheid. Medical apartheid, because that type of thing is what they fled from in Iran. I started this question without realizing there wasn't a question at the end of it. Let me find.
But let me say something very quickly about these communities. I mean, it's really interesting to me to note that so much of the most kind of attuned attitudes, emotionally, politically, intellectually, come in America from three communities. They come from the Syrians, Syrian Jews, Persian Jews, and Russian Jews, because these are groups that have been on the outside for so long, they didn't yet have the opportunity to go through this kind of like assimilation process and feel themselves sort of like snugly and smugly a part of the American collective mainstream story. So they're much more likely to think clearly and not to accept all kinds of orthodoxies like, yes, now you must wear a mask. Now you must no longer wear a mask. Now wear the mask again. They ask these difficult questions. And when they notice that the questioning itself, that you're no longer allowed to question certain elements, and I think COVID is a wonderful example of us completely not being able to have a free, unfettered, reasonable discussion without being labeled X or Y or Z. When that happens, they realize, having experienced persecution firsthand, that something very bad for the Jews is afoot.
Rabbi Carrie Kosberg asks, is it possible that American Jews who are more comfortable in the contemporary Western cultural zeitgeist than in Jewish beliefs will go the way of Hellenized Jewry in the first to fourth centuries?
Well, I recall that there's a festival of light coming up that addresses this question precisely. Yes, the instinct, or I should say the appeal of Hellenization has forever been tremendous. Being accepted by the majority, being loved by your self-appointed intellectual and moral betters, being that naked and oily, Greek god at the gymnasium, all those have a very distinct appeal and always will have. But this holiday, commemorating the victory of a cult of, or I should say, a group of bearded zealots over fighting what was very much a civil war, over their assimilating brothers, which is not at all the way that the Hanukkah story is told in these here United States, I think will serve as a perpetual reminder that those among us who adhere to the ancient traditions and the ancient storylines, we're on the team that always wins.
There are a number of questions on the subject of Jewish institutions. Elliot Spoon asks, do we need new Jewish institutions? I'm thinking of, for example, the ADL. During this unprecedented time of hostile attitudes to Jews on campus and elsewhere, the ADL on Halloween tweeted to be careful of costumes you wear and cultural appropriation. That strikes me as tone deaf and a focus on issues irrelevant to Jews today. Care to comment?
I will never miss an opportunity in print or in a spoken session to say how absolutely vile and despicable the ADL has become under its current leadership, and how I deeply lament the fact that it has betrayed the safety and well-being of real live Jews in order to partake in this march of follies of identity politics, political correctness, and Democratic Party shenanigans. Hopefully, this organization too will return to its glorious roots. And thankfully, there are plenty other Jewish organizations out there who still do the Lord's work.
Now, Mark Charendoff, who just happens to be my publisher, asks a question, and I think I'm going to ask it out loud here. He says, Liel, love your notion of think small, but does that really work in the current American Jewish experience? Small communities are hard to sustain. They fall apart. Leadership is hard to foster. In a culturally and educationally rich Jewish community, it's a great strategy, maybe, but in a community of think commitments, Isn't it the blind leading the blind? That's a pretty good question.
I think it's an amazing question. And Mark, I look forward to discussing it at great length and over many drinks. I will say several things though, because I think your prescription I agree with your prescription completely, yet not necessarily with your bottom line. First of all, that is just another invitation to making sure that the commitments and the ties to Jewish intellectual life are much, much, much deeper, which is something that, you know, the organization, Marky, yourself had, and we're all beneficiaries of the Maimonides Fund, does beautifully with every podcast, with every journal, with every publication, with every group, with every initiative that we put out there. We make sure that people are just a little bit more knowledgeable, just a little bit more committed, just a little bit less, to carry on, Mark, with your metaphor, just a little bit less blind. That's number one. Number two, again, I think if we look at the sort of the astonishing story of Jewish survival through the generations, the thing that kind of always rocked me the most was to see these people leading completely disparate lives in environments that were radically different from one another at a time where you couldn't easily communicate, and yet maintain a kind of, with a local flavor, with a local sensibility, but a kind of uniform commitment and adherence to the same ancient stories, to the same ancient tradition, to the same ancient practices. The fact that Jews in Morocco and Yemen and Denmark and Germany and France could have more or less the same storyline going on, with slight but important twists on their own stories throughout the course of time itself, and facing far greater hardships than the ones we face now, suggests to me that this insistence on locality isn't folly. And in the meantime, I think what we could do is precisely this: making the ties among these communities stronger, and making the ties of individuals themselves to the tradition, to the big story, stronger as well.
Sam Hillard asks, are we supposed to ignore the leftist Jewish students or accept them as a lost cause?
That is a tremendous question.
I mean, weren't you a lost leftist at one point in your past?
Correct, which is exactly why I am very slow to say, you know, shun everyone and anyone who disagrees with you, or put up any kinds of silly, you know, litmus tests to belonging to the tribe. Here's what I believe, and I believe it very strongly. It sometimes sounds kind of, you know, a little bit strange, but I think it is coherent. I think you should have a robust, warm, open dialogue with anyone who wishes to have a robust, warm, open dialogue with you, but no dialogue at all with anyone who doesn't. In other words, if I come to the table with a person and say, I think you're a flippin' fascist, I disagree with everything you say, and I want to spend the next 6 hours having three bottles of wine and having a real conversation, which I really actually want to listen to you, and I want you to listen to me, I would do that with great joy. If someone approaches a conversation, as sadly, too many people, especially too many young people who are what we call extremely online do these days, and Brett, you would know nothing about this because you had never suffered any attempt to be silenced online by anyone. So let me tell you about this. If someone comes and say, like, I'm engaging in this exchange mainly because I want you, Brett Stevens, gone. I don't think you should have a job. I don't think you should have a platform. I want you silenced. That's the moment, again, keeping with the old Zionist credo, in which I turn and say, you know, a few four-letter words that I won't repeat on this forum, and not even bother engaging in a conversation because there is no point. So I think
those words would be go and yourself.
Correct.
Let me get to Stu Halpern's question. What do you see as the role of legacy Jewish institutions, synagogues, federations, Jewish universities in the next 50 years of American Jewish life in an era of Substacks, TikTok, and whatever Meta will be?
This would be...
I see Meta, I think of Zubin Mehta, but this is a different Meta.
Right. He's now the head of Facebook.
Zubin Mehta is?
Yeah, that's why they named the company Mehta. This, by the way, would be my dear friend Stu Halpern of Yeshiva University, the Hogwarts of the Jewish people. And I'm grateful to him for this question, because I think it is very easy, particularly if you're in my position and you sort of get paid to write sort of, you know, fiery fist-shaking missives, to advocate a kind of, you know, barn burning approach, say, you know, the hell with all of them, kind of scorch the earth and rebuild anew. I don't subscribe to that approach. And the older I get, the less I believe in it. I think we're blessed to have among us a host of institutions that are still offering, there are many, as I said, the ADL being first and foremost among them who have lost their way completely, but there are many more who are still offering an unbelievably valuable and necessary example. Yeshiva University is one of them, a place where the spiritual, emotional, intellectual leaders of the Jewish people are being trained today and being trained by really an incomparably great cadre of scholars who engage with Jewish tradition and with the world. That is an institution we can't afford to lose. There are institutions like the AJC who sort of do work all over the globe and try to understand, you know, the standing of the Jews in the kind of global setting that we need very much. Institutions, again, like the one in whose good graces we are today, the Maimonides Fund, that supports so many of these initiatives of making people more tethered, more passionate, more proud of their Jewish heritage, without which we would be adrift at sea. Those are institutions that we need to support kind of with.
Let me push you on that. Look, for different, I mean, different strokes for different folks, right? I mean, you don't like the ADL. It serves a function. It has its supporters. It has its work. There's an organization, J Street, which many people detest, but you might argue also is, you know, is part of this kind of let a thousand flowers bloom.
No, because I precisely disagree with this analysis. They don't serve
a function. Not an analysis, it's a provocation. I want to know.
Right, well, the function of the Anti-Defamation League is to protect Jews from harassment. Once it decides that what it wants to do is pretend like it's doing this thing, but really advance the goals and the causes of the Democratic Party, then it's no longer doing what it's supposed to do. If J Street comes to me and says, well, I am interested in being pro-peace, pro-Israeli, pro-Palestinian, but demonstrably is falling on at least one of these commitments, then I am, I think, at liberty to come and say, hey, you know, whatever it is that you're trying to sell here, you're not actually doing. It's less a question of diversity of causes and goals. It's more a question of candor and honesty. I think if any Jewish organization that is engaged honestly in an attempt to better the life of the Jewish people, and that candidly looks at its success and changes direction accordingly, trying to actually have an impact on the real lives of real Jews, that's an organization I love and support and think we all have a commitment to try and see if we could, you know, make it part of this ecosystem. Some will fizzle, some will thrive. And again, we've never stopped inventing new ways of being Jewish, and I don't think we ever will.
Last question, because I want to be mindful of people's time. David Seldon asks, Liel, where are you seeing experiential Jewish humor and joy, aside from Simchas Torah, opening hearts and minds to the richness of lived Jewish life and community?
Where am I seeing this? I'm seeing it everywhere. I'm seeing it right now. Look at us. It's 1:30 on a Thursday. What are you know, 200 and something of us doing? Sitting here at our homes and having a kind of real, dynamic and sometimes jagged conversation about the Jewish future. Why do we choose to be here instead of napping on the couch or taking a walk? At least here in New York, it's a nice day. We do it because we care. I see it in the podcast that I host that attract many, many, many more people than I would have thought were interested necessarily in the subject matters of this conversation, and then continue these conversations in all kinds of online forms because they want to hold space together. I see it in the million and one little chavurot, the little study and prayer groups that I could walk to from my apartment on 94th and West End on any given Shabbos because these people want to be together and do the work. The energy is absolutely there. Some of the old institutions have gone. Some of the old modes of worship are changing. Some of the old assumptions are being tested. A lot of the kind of social, political, economic zeitgeist is rapidly shifting. But the same love, the same commitment that has led us to do more or less the same things in more or less the same way for 5,000 years now, those are still there. And I really believe what I said. We're on the team that always wins. Never forget that.
Liel, that's a wonderful note on which to end this wonderful conversation. I really want to thank you for an extraordinary essay. It should be widely read. But I really want to thank the people, the 200 odd people who tuned in, as you said, in the middle of a weekday afternoon to this conversation, because it matters not only to us, it matters to them. And that engagement is just wonderful to behold. Thanks to the Maimonides Fund, which has really put this whole effort together. And to my wonderful colleagues at Sapir, Felicia Herman and Ariella Saperstein, and Mark Cherendoff, for creating events like this, which are little experiments in Jewish living. If John Stuart Mill had been John Stuart Rabinowitz, that's what he might have said. So have a lovely afternoon. And next week with Harold Jacobson, a great English novelist, and many more such conversations to come. Enjoy the rest of your days.
Thank you. Later.